So you say.
All right. Well, again, hopefully everybody had a wonderful Pesach, enjoyable, perhaps even, I know it certainly was caloric. Hopefully it was somewhat inspirational and you got more out of it than just a few pounds. It was wonderful. I appreciated having the opportunity to spend time with my family, which was really, really special. And but I'm ready to go. We're in the final stretch of the adult ed year. Hard to believe, but we are moving into the final few weeks before camp becomes absolutely overwhelming, which we're almost there already. But we are going to plow through because we have a lot to cover.
I think so.
And we left off last time before we spoke about the holiday. We were in the first paragraph of Shema and we spoke about tefillin. And I said that we have one more major topic to cover, and that is about the mitzvah of mezuzah. The last verse of the first paragraph of Shema ends with the famous words of Uchasavtam al mezuzos beisecho visharecha, you shall write them, right? You shall write them al mezuzos beisecho, on the doorposts of your house and of your gates. This is actually not limited to your home, but actually the mitzvah includes, if you've ever been to the old city in Jerusalem and you go through one of the gates, embedded in the stone of the gateway is a mezuzah. It's embedded in that gate, in the stone, as you pass through, whether it be Jaffa Gate or Damascus Gate. I think all of them have it embedded in the stone itself. This is a mitzvah, a biblical mitzvah for us to have a mezuzah. I could literally spend the entire class just going through the technicalities about the mitzvah. What is it? Where is it placed? What defines a doorway? There's a lot of technicalities and details to it. But my intention tonight is really to take a step back and perhaps look at some aspects of the mezuzah itself and some of the really important lessons that we can learn regarding it. So let's start with the basics. I think everybody here is familiar with what a mezuzah is, but I don't want to take it for granted. A mezuzah is a piece of parchment. Contrary to a popular belief that the mezuzah is just that cool, funky thing sitting on your doorpost that we spend who knows how much money to find the latest and greatest artistic design of it, that's all beautiful. Don't get me wrong. Go for it. Do it. But that's not the mezuzah. This tiny little scroll that I'm holding in my hand, that is rolled up actually, is the actual mezuzah. This is the actual parchment. This tiny little thing that I'm holding. This is the writing in Hebrew. Hopefully it comes out from right to left in the way you're looking at it. But it has two paragraphs. Paragraph one starts here and ends there, and paragraph two goes till the bottom. There's two paragraphs. You know what the two paragraphs are? The first two paragraphs of Shema. That's what we're studying. The first two are actually written like it is in a Torah scroll on a piece of parchment with black ink by a scribe who knows what they're doing. It is always written, and again, I'm just going to throw stuff at you. I'm not going to explain all of it, but if you want to check out a real mezuzah, make sure that it is written on 22 lines. It's not haphazard and, oh, we'll just fit it in however we can on the piece of parchment. No, ladies and gentlemen, it has to be 22 lines. Some of you are like, I never knew that. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, but here's what else is interesting. I've shown you the inside, the part that actually gets rolled on itself. But what I didn't show you carefully is that on the outside is also something. This is the outside. See, this part is the blank, right? Here's the inside. This is the outside. You have a name, a shin, a dalid, and a yud in Torah script. Shin, dalid, and yud. It's one of God's names. We'll get a chance. We'll talk a little bit about that. But That has to be on the back. One more thing, just to show you, again, on the back, on the outside part, there's also something written at the very top. And what I'm doing is I'm going to turn it upside down. Do me a favor, folks. Read it with your eyes. Don't pronounce it. Just do me that favor. Not that you could, but without vowels, most people have difficulty. It's three words. It's chaf, and then a vav, a zayin, and a vav. Next word has beis. Mem, it's hard to read upside down. Mem, vav, chaf, samach, zayin, and then again, chaf, vav, zayin, vav. What is it? Yeah. When we get to our Kabbalistic concepts, we'll talk about this one day. It's a Kabbalistic rendition of God's name. I'm just going to leave it at there for you. Okay. This is the actual mezuzah. Two paragraphs of the Shema that are, as I said, written on 22 lines with the name of God of the Shin, the Dalet, and the Yud written on the back together with that Kabbalistic writing of it. Fine. Now, what am I supposed to do with that scroll? Well, the Torah says you shall affix it to the doorpost of your home. Well, which side of the doorposts? You have two of them. You also have a lintel above your head as you pass through. Where do I put it? So the law is you put it on the right side of the door, the right doorpost. And yes, Liz, the question in or out, the answer is as you go into the room, it should be affixed to the right-hand doorpost as you enter the room. Where on that doorpost? Well, it should be placed, listen to the words carefully. It should be placed at the bottom of the top third of the doorpost. So for argument's sake, let's just pretend the doorpost is only 30 inches tall, which really is problematic. But let's just, for 90, let's make it 90 inches, nice and simple. 90 inches tall, perfect. Where do you place it? Well, the mezuzah's bottom should be at the 30-inch mark from the top, the 60-inch mark on the way from the bottom, however you want to phrase it. But it needs to sit at the bottom of the top third of the right side doorway. And lastly, is that it's not vertical, nor is it horizontal on the doorpost. It is done on a slant. Which direction? Slanted inward or outward? Inward. We always look forward, right? So picture it in your mind. It's the right doorpost. As you enter the room, it's almost as if an arrow pointing, go this way, follow this road into the house, into the room. Those are the basics regarding the mezuzah. Now, you know, one of the important lessons about a mezuzah. Why would the Torah ask us to do this? It is a little strange. I've had people come into my home, people who are not familiar with the practices of Judaism, and come into my house and either see it or sees one of us reach out and actually touch the case that holds the mezuzah and give it a kiss, which of course piques their interest in what's up with that. You know, most people don't kiss their doorposts. They kiss their spouse when they come in. They can kiss their kids, hug the dog, right? Who's kissing a doorpost and what's up with that? So depending on how much time I have, I usually boil it down to that it's part of the security system that we have. So they all laugh. They all laugh. But then I tell them that's the honest truth. The mezuzah is part of our security system. Why do I say that? The Torah teaches us that the power of the mezuzah is there as a protection of those who reside in the house. It is. It is truly part of your spiritual protection. It is your security system. I'll show you how we can remember it, but I want to share a story with you. The story is actually recorded in the Talmud about a tremendous individual. I may have shared this story in the past. The fellow's name was Unklus. Unkelos. In Hebrew, in English, it's spelled U-N-K-E-L-O-S, Unkelos. Okay, Unkelos, he was a convert to Judaism. Listen to this story. You guys all know this story?
No.
This is an amazing story. Unkelos was actually the nephew of one of the great Roman generals. One of the great Roman generals, and this is during the era of where the Romans were beginning to take control over the region and ultimately come into the land of Israel and destroy the Second Temple. But the story goes, this fellow Unkelos went around, I guess, the world or wherever it was, and came across Judaism. He traveled and he got to Israel and found out about Judaism and was extremely inspired and started to study and stayed in Israel and continued to study. Meanwhile, back in Rome, his uncle, the great general, is like, where's my nephew? I haven't seen him in ages. What's going on here? He sends out some messengers to find Unkelos. And after a period of time, they find out that he's studying Judaism in Israel. So he sends messengers to bring him back and to get him off of this ridiculous, rebellious phase of his. My goodness, how could somebody take the time to want to... Okay, so he sends these messengers. These messengers come to Unkelos, and they say, your uncle wants you back in Rome and to stop this study of Judaism. He said to them, I'm sorry, the story goes that he had a whole conversation with them, and he convinced them of the veracity of Judaism, and they said, you know what, he's onto something, and they decided they were going to stay also. The uncle didn't like this. He dispatched a second group, again, gets into dialogue and all the different proofs and blah, blah, blah. They're off the deep end like Tachman. Okay, fine. The third group comes along. The third group, this is in the Talmud. The third group comes and he gives in strict instructions. Do not have a conversation with him. Just bring him back. Obviously, he's a persuasive guy. He's got the charisma. Don't talk to him. Right? Great strategy. Just bring him back. I don't care how you do it. They get to him and he wants to have a conversation. They're like, nope. We were told strict instructions. So as they're leading him out of his home, he reaches up and he kisses the mezuzah. Gives it a kiss. These messengers cannot control themselves. And they're like, what are you doing? What is up with this? And Unkelos tells them the following. And this is why I want to share this with you. He said, I'll tell you why the God of Israel is different than everybody else. Every king in the world is situated that the king and his family are on the inside of the palace and the guards are there on the outside protecting the king. That's how it's normally set. But the God of Israel said, I do it differently. I want all of the servants on the inside, and I, God, will stand guard and protect them on the inside of their palace. These men were shocked at what a concept. And they too decided to stay. At this point, the uncle gave up, and Unkelos converted to Judaism and became one of the greatest insightful scholars who wrote a commentary on the Torah. It is studied around the world by almost everybody who studies. Rashi's commentary and Unkelos's commentary are the two that are printed in almost every Chumash around the world. That is the story of Unkelos the convert. And he used this idea of how the mezuzah was God's protection of the people inside. Some of the commentators suggest, that the name, the Shin, the Dalet, and the Yud, that is written on the outside of the mezuzah, is an acronym. Normally, I'll pronounce it just so you know you're familiar with it. The name that's written, that God's name, is called Shaddai. Okay, I've said it the one time. The rest of the time, I'm going to use a pseudonym because I don't like to say God's name. I just pronounce it as Shakai. I just, you know, substitute a letter there so it's not the real name. But these three letters, Shin, Dalet, and Yud, some suggest that it's an acronym for, the Shin stands for Shomer. Shomer means guard. Daltot, The Dalet stands for doorways. Dalet is a door. The Yud stands for Yisrael, of the Jewish people. This name of God is the guardian of the doorways of Israel. Can you imagine the scene? The king is standing guard for the servants on the inside. Yeah, that's how this works. In fact, when the Torah says to write the mezuzah, it says uchsaftem al mezuzot, right? It's plural, mezuzot. It's spelled, if you were to unscramble those letters, it spells the word zaz mavet. Go away, shoo, death. You're not welcome here. God stands guard and said, I don't want that here. Any kind of negativity, plagues, death, hurt, pain, you don't belong here. Now, obviously, it's not to the exclusion that nobody who ever has a mezuzah will never die, but there is a certain level of protection. And I want to share with you two stories that happened with me. Okay? I'm not a prophet. I can't hold a Torah and swear that this is how, but I am pretty darn confident that it fulfilled this idea. The first story happened when I was living in Columbus. It was a particular family that I became close with, and we did a session about different mitzvot around the home. The name of the class was The Jewish Home, and we went room by room. The dining room we talked about inviting guests, the mitzvah. In the kitchen, we talked about the mitzvah of kosher, and we talked about all the different rooms. The living room should have a Jewish library, and we came to the mitzvah of mezuzah. And this woman told me that while she grew up with it, her home did not have one. They recently had moved to a new home and did not have a mezuzah. And I said, fine, so let's find a day that I'll come over. We'll affix a mezuzah to your door. You can do it. I'll show you the bracha. And, you know, you'll take care of it and fulfill the mitzvah. One thing led to another. We didn't get it done. It just time got away from us and we got busy. And it just never worked out. The week before Rosh Hashanah, it was bothering me. It was bothering me that I had not done what I had set out to do. I didn't want her starting a new year without that mitzvah. So I called, and maybe 2 days before Rosh Hashanah, I went to our home, and thank God we put up the mezuzah. We made a big deal about it. Great. Fabulous. I felt much better. 2 weeks later, I was getting ready to leave to go visit my parents for Sukkot, which is exactly 2 weeks after Rosh Hashanah. So sometime between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, this story takes place. I get a call from a friend of mine who said to me that that family who I just affixed the mezuzah to, their daughter had a brain aneurysm and was in the hospital. Young girl, teenager, terrible situation. And I told my wife, I said, we can't go until I go visit. I have to go to the hospital. I went to the hospital. And the father, who I did not have as close a relationship with, because his wife was really the one who attended my classes and really arranged for this, and he greets me. I come up to the floor and I say, I'm so sorry, I heard the news. He looked me straight in the eye and he said, this is your fault. I said, I'm sorry. He says, everything was fine until you put that thing up on our door. Now, I was still young and I had the foolish, youthful zest within me that I was ready to argue and say, I think you got it bad. But I got smart really, really fast and I kept my mouth shut, knowing that this was not the time and place. So I took the abuse. I showed my face. I wished them well and I went in to visit a couple of minutes and I left. But it bothered me. Boy, did it bother me. I had a chance. Thank God the girl recovered and pretty much within a relatively short period of time was back to herself. It was really miraculous. I met this fellow a few months later and I said to him, how's so-and-so doing? He said, oh, she's doing great. It's wonderful. I said, do you remember when I came visiting you in the hospital when she first was admitted? I said, yeah. I said, do you remember what you said to me? No. I said, well, you greeted me with, it's my fault, and that since I put up that thing on the door, that's what did it. I said, tell me, what happened? Like, what was the situation with your daughter? He said, well, she was taking a shower in the morning, and in the shower, she had that aneurysm. That vessel burst. And I said, what are the odds of someone surviving that? Oh, very, very slim, Rabbi. Really, really. I said, and how did anyone find her? Well, it happened to be, and he gives me this whole coincidental situation of someone was home and that got her right to the hospital, and the doctor who specializes in this was in the hospital. A whole long story. And I said, wow, that's really miraculous. Can I ask you a question? One more question. He goes, yeah. I said, maybe you have it backwards. Maybe it's that thing I put up on the door that saved your daughter. I never thought about it that way, Rabbi. I said, yeah, you're welcome. We became very good friends after that. But you never know, folks. There's a power. I can't explain it. I can't promise. But if this girl was to have an aneurysm at taking a shower by herself, no one else, the chances of her surviving and being quote unquote completely back to normal were slim to nil. That's story number one. Story number two happened to me just a year ago. We had a situation here in my house, here in Baltimore. Long story short, I don't want to take up the whole class. There's so much I want to learn with you. But the long and short of it is that I was having difficulty with certain lights in my dining room. I had an electrician come in. I tried to fix it. It didn't work. I'm pretty handy. Don't get nervous. Right? But it just, I couldn't get the timer to work. Something just, it just wasn't working. So Cheapskate Tuchman was going to try this, but fine. I called a friend. He tried to walk me through it. It didn't work. He said, stop being a cheapskate. Call an electrician. Just get it done. Fine. I call the guy. And of course, it's a Friday morning. Of course, it has to be right before Shabbos. It's Friday morning. And his secretary says he's out on a job. He'll call me soon. Yeah, I know what that means. I'll call you Monday. But no, literally within half an hour, he calls me. I explain the situation. He says, I'll be over this afternoon. It's like, wow, I'm ready. Two steps ahead. This is great. He returned the call and said he'd come that day. Fine. Comes over and he literally starts testing and he gets this furrow in his brow. Like something's not right. He said to me, what's up with this? Is this light switch control only this one light? I said, no, it's all the recessed lighting in the room. He says, the recess in the attic. I said, yeah. He says, do you have access to it? I said, yeah. So we move the stuff, we go up to the attic, and literally I open up the hatch or whatever you want to call it to go up, and you could smell fire. You could smell fire. No flames, but you could smell something was burning. What it turned out to be is that one of the recessed lighting fixtures had shorted out, and the wire that had been there connecting all the others was, you know, pretty much smoldering the joists of the attic, of the roof. You could see the char marks. The insulation around it is all charred. It was only a matter of minutes, probably, before the whole thing, God forbid, could have caught. Put it out. Thank God. Amazing. It really was a miraculous thing. My wife says to me, when things were all calm and we got taken care of fine, she said to me, I don't understand. Didn't we just not that long ago have all of our mezuzahs in the house checked? Didn't we just upgrade some of them that we weren't so thrilled with? We wanted a better quality. Why would this happen? We just changed it. It's supposed to be protection in the house. I looked at my wife and I said, exactly. It worked. What are the odds that an electrician returned my call within a half an hour, came over, decided to check the attic and find the fire before it really got dangerous? Yeah. I truly, truly, truly believe that it was Hashem protecting us. I don't know why, but it was miraculous. Thank God. I'm telling you, folks, there is a power to the mezuzah. It is part of our security system. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, please.
My nephew's home burnt down a year ago. And he was sleeping upstairs. And his wife happened to come home in the nick of time, woke him, and they lost a couple pets. They rebuilt the home. They just moved in maybe a week before Pesach. I called the rabbi there. And my gift to them was to make sure they had new mezuzahs that were intact. I didn't want them using the old ones because I felt strongly that it is protection.
It is. It is. You're 100% right, Michelle. And there are probably hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories like this, most of which we don't even know because that's how our security system works. It's there to protect. Who knows? That's all I got to say about it. Let's talk about this a little bit in terms of lessons, what we have here. So first of all, the concept of why do we give it a kiss whenever we go in and when we go out? Why is that? So on a very simple level, I think when we enter the home, we have certain things that we want to remind ourselves. A home is the largest and most expensive purchase that most of us make in our lifetime. It is the numero uno possession that we call ours. We always have these great expression, a man's castle, a king's castle. And it may be our castle, but it's definitely my wife's main, you know, I just work here. But it's the main possession of a person. We need to remind ourselves as we go into our beautiful homes that is a possession that truly does not belong to us. It is God's dwelling who graciously has granted us the usage of it. I didn't do this on my own. It's a recognition that all of my material possessions are divinely bestowed gifts. And we need to remember as we walk into our beautiful homes, and we should take pleasure in that home. Put your hand up to the mezuzah and give it a kiss as a means of saying, I recognize that thank you, Hashem, for giving me such a beautiful home, for allowing me to have a job that I could have a home. Don't take it for granted. If you don't eat food without acknowledging, you know, God being the source of it, how much more so when we talk about greater possessions? The home is our primary possession, and therefore we put it right on the doorpost, which is the part of the building that symbolizes control, what goes in and what comes out. I close my door. I open my door. I want certain things. One might be led to believe you are in control. This is all about you. No, right there on the doorpost, we remind ourselves, no, I am not the one in total control. I am not the one as in total, you know, in charge of it all. It's a reminder that ultimately this is God's home as well. But there's more. And I think if you take the time to contemplate what I'm going to share with you, you'll have such a greater appreciation for what your home is. The Talmud tells us that all three of the patriarchs referred to the temple area by three different names or symbols. The Talmud says that Abraham referred to it as a mountain. In this conversation about where he was going to bring Isaac as the binding, God told him. And it says that Avram lifted up his eyes towards the mountain. That's how he pictured the temple area. Obviously, the temple wasn't there yet, but that area, Avram's connection to it was as a mountain. Yitzchak referred to it as a field, and only Jacob referred to it as a home, a house. And there's various verses that show all of this. Let's see if we can try to talk about the function of the temple and how that relates to our home. There's basically three functions of the temple that stood in Jerusalem. Number one, it's like a mountain. It was a place to ascend, a place that we looked up to, a place that inspired us to feel the presence of God, to want to be better, to grow. It's that lofty ideals that I want to live my life for. That's the mountain. We always picture this beautiful, majestic mountain of wanting to grow and to be tall and reach these high pinnacles of success. But the temple also was like a field. It was a place for growth and development. It was an environment that was conducive to bring out the emotions of a person, to express one's heartfelt feelings in relationship to God. That's much more like a field of where you plant something and you nurture it and you have things grow. And finally, the home, the house, the temple, was all-encompassing. It was the nature of where you felt enveloped by everything around you. It wasn't only a place of lofty ideals, and it wasn't limited to a place of where I grew. It was my natural habitat. This was home. This is where I felt comfortable. If we think about it, our homes are very much in line with that as well. It's basically a home, if you strip it down to its bare basics, are four walls, a door. Perhaps if you're fortunate, you have a window. But it's four walls, a roof, and a door. That's what it is. The walls serve three functions. The walls basically create an interior area. I love this concept. It's my private domain. I'm separated from my outside domain. It's not just in a physical sense that I close the door and now people can't come in. It's more than that. We create an environment of where my values are created and lived here. The outside of the door, what's out in society, does not necessarily jive with what my priorities are, what my value system is. The walls create an inner sanctum that allows that spirituality, that guidance in my life, that serves as a foundation of the Torah learning, observance, all of that. The walls create that inner sanctum. But what else it does is it forms a partition that encompasses and almost unites all those who occupy the inner area. I don't just share a room. I don't just share that, this is like a dorm. My kids live in one area. I live in another. It just happens to be. No. We are a unit. We are unified together. It's ironic. Maybe it's not ironic. Maybe it's purposely done this way. Marital harmony. What a novel concept. You know what it's called in Hebrew? Anybody? It's called Shalom Bayit.
Oh, yeah.
Shalom Bayit literally means peace in the house, peace in the home. That's a funny way. Why did you just say marital harmony? Hello. We got words for both of those in Hebrew. Because that's the functionality. If you have truly built that home, you created an environment of where there's harmony, where there's a great relationship. Of course, obviously, you have to work on it and there's ups and downs. And I'm not looking at it through rose-colored glasses. But what we do in a good, healthy relationship is to nurture that between spouses, between parents and children and grandchildren. That's the beauty of it. It's shalom bayit of the home. That's the second function. And the third, it's also, as I said, it's a buffer against any destructive foreign influences that perhaps are hostile to the Torah values. Once the inner area is infused with sanctity and purpose, you know what? I have the ability to use that and let that go out into the world. I'll tell you a fascinating concept. Any architects here? Any wannabe architects? Most homes are built of where the windows are designed, both in their structure and how they're put into the homes, so that it takes light from the outside to bring it into the home. That's the way it's designed, so that light, sunshine, and nice natural light comes pouring into the home. The windows in the Temple of Jerusalem were designed opposite. The windows were designed to take, so to say, the light from within the temple and shine it outward into the world. What a fascinating concept, because that's the function of the temple in Jerusalem. so that the spirituality, if you want a picture, for me, it's always when I light the Hanukkah menorah. When I light that menorah and I do it by the windowsill, I'm not looking for all that to come in. Oh no, just the opposite, my friends. I want the light, that spirituality that it represents. When I light that menorah, I want it shining out into the street. I want the world to become a brighter place, but it starts in my home. That's where it is. Once I create that inner sanctum of sanctity, of purpose, I want the light from inside projected out to the outside world. There are many mitzvot, I'm not going to spend the time tonight, but there are mitzvot that are specifically to be done in the home. The lighting of the candles for Shabbat, putting up a mezuzah on the doorways. If you have a deck or some sort, you put a fence or guardrail of some sort. That's a mitzvah in the Torah to protect. Somebody shouldn't, God forbid, fall off. Looking for the chametz before Pesach, the search for chametz. The lighting of the menorah, the Chanukah, right, the candles. There's so many like that. That's the idea, that when I come into my home and I give that mezuzah and acknowledgement, I'm doing two things. I'm number one, acknowledging, reminding that this fabulous possession is a gift from God. And I don't want to forget that. I'm coming into this beautiful home. Thank you, Hashem. But I also am reminding myself that this is the home where I have to nurture my spiritual core, create that inner sanctum, because sadly, the world's values do not necessarily align with ours. And I need to know that. And I can't have an open door policy of all the schmutz out there to come into my home either. Got to be careful. Okay. But how about kissing it when we leave the home? There's also that. It's not just when we enter. Perhaps using this idea, we can understand that when we leave our home, the Torah is acknowledging a fact. And the fact is that we are easily influenced by the environment in which we find ourselves. If I go out and I hang out with the wrong crowd, I could be a wonderful individual, but it's not going to take long before I start changing my ways and acting accordingly, the way that environment now is. The more I expose myself to those not necessarily aligned values, the more I'm influenced. The minute you think you can't be influenced or you have it so rock solid that you don't have to worry, that's the day you go see a doctor because you are ill. Because it's not true. Our nature is to become influenced. That's the nature. The Torah acknowledges that fact, and therefore we need constant reminders of what our priorities are. When I go out into that world that is not necessarily aligned with my values, I put my hand up to the mezuzah and I remind myself, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Listen, Israel, there is one God and that God is mine. And I take those values seriously, even though I'm going into hostile territory. I remind myself, almost like a last minute hurrah, a great pep talk from the coach as we go down the tunnel out into the stadium. We got this. Let's do this. Come on. It's a last minute reminder. And also the reminder that all the wealth and all the honor that's received when we go out there and we have wonderful jobs and we're given this honor and success. Yes, it's necessary that I have to put in the effort to the best of my ability, but never should I forget that it's been a help, that the God that I, from my house, I take with me out into the real world. I have my ethic values. I have all of my integrity. I'm not going to let that influence me. Okay. Okay, more. It's not limited to your front door. Again, this is probably myth number 179. It's not just for your front door. The Torah tells us it really belongs on every doorway in your house except the bathroom. That's your one exception. And no, it's not because God isn't there either, but it's just not appropriate to have a Torah scroll, a mezuzah with God's name sitting there as you're sitting on your throne. It's just not a good look. However, every other room in the house should have a mezuzah. It really should. And there's a great lesson to that as well. We are not supposed to be just public displays of our Judaism. You know, people who all right, I got to be careful here. I have a theory. I don't know if it's true, and I don't want to know if it's true or not. But I have a theory that people who have excessive public displays of affection are probably having difficulties in their relationship. I'm just throwing it out there. Don't shake your head yay or nay. It's a theory. If people have, and I'm not saying you can't have it, but if there's an over-the-top, almost a concerted effort to show the world that we're so in love with each other, it's likely there's some rocky road there. It's a theory. The same is true when it comes to people who are over-the-top in their excessive display on the outside of their Judaism. What about the inside? When we close the door and nobody's watching, how are we doing there? Do we go ahead and have those values that we display publicly to everybody? Do we really behave properly inside and private? Do we treat our spouse? Do we just rip on everybody else outside? You know, like once you close the door, oh my God, I can't wait to unload all this Lashon Hara. But outside, I'm like, no, can't talk Lashon Hara. No. Right? It's almost like I come home and I say, oh, thank God, Ilana. I just play a rabbi on TV. I can tell you the real truth now. It can't work that way, folks. It's not just your outer door. It's got to be your inner doors also. We behave as Jews publicly, privately, in the dining room, the way we behave in the kitchen, what we do in the kitchen, what goes on in the bedrooms. Yes. Judaism has what to teach us. The Torah has values. Don't think it's only in public that we need to behave a certain way. And inside, don't worry. It's not true. It really belongs on all of them, all the doors. Okay. One more point. Really many more points, but here's a good one. The Talmud makes the following interesting statement. It gives us a good bit of advice of what kind of personality we should strive to have. The Talmud says that a person should be soft and flexible like a reed, R-E-E-D, and not hard like a cedar tree. That's what the Talmud says. Why? The Talmud says because if you're soft and flexible like a reed, then you'll merit to have quills taken from it so that you can write a Torah, write tefillin, write a mezuzah. We don't use Bic pens when we write this stuff. The sofer, the scribe, use a quill, a real quill. Could be from a goose, a chicken, whatever. They don't have feathers like that. Whatever, he uses a quill. You guys know what a quill is, right? The Talmud says that you use a quill because that's the personality, to be flexible. If you ever watch the reeds in the wind, it flows. You know, the wind blows this way, it leans that way. And it blows this way, it leans that way. A cedar tree, it can handle a lot of it. But when it gets to a point of where it can't handle the strong winds, it breaks. It doesn't go with it and come back to its center point. Either it survives or it breaks. The Talmud says a person should strive to have that personality. What does that mean? I think what's being said here is that we need to have an open mind and a willingness to learn more, not just in quantity, but in quality. And even those things, perish the thought, I'm going to say it, even those things that are forcing us to rethink what we thought we knew or to rethink what we thought was right. If you are closed and standing strong like a cedar, this is what I know, this is how I've always done it, then you're missing out. You might be missing out. I'm not suggesting that we become willy-nilly for everybody's ideas. You do have to stand strong for your principles, but you have to be willing to have an open mind and don't say, well, this was good enough for my father and grandfather, therefore it's good enough for me. It doesn't work that way. We have to be willing. You know, my grandfather was an amazing individual. He lost his job every single week because he refused to work on Shabbos, right? That's the way it was. They said to him, if you're not going to come in on Saturday, don't bother coming in on Sunday. And okay, so he would change jobs pretty much every week. You know, so what should I do? Obviously, I also want to keep Shabbos, but you know, the times were different. There were so many more challenges that they had to face. So what I should say, okay, it was good enough for them. It's good enough for me, but I'm blessed. I got a yeshiva. I got a day school education. Just suffice that I can say Psalms. I should be patting myself on the back that I can say Psalms. How about learning a little Talmud, Tachman? You know, push yourself. You have an opportunity. Yeah. Well, it was good enough for my Zaidi. It's good enough for me. No. You have to be able to push yourself. Be willing. Be flexible to open ideas. Be willing to grow. But I think, and I'll end with this. I think that this is perhaps teaching us about being flexible in interpersonal relationships as well. You know, we all know that the biggest fights and struggles that we get into in life are with those that we feel the closest to. There is nothing like a family feud. Man, that tops the charts. You get into a fight with your friend. Okay. Yeah. No. You try to get over it. But if not, okay. He goes his way, she goes her way, and okay. But with family, it's tough. If it's a family feud, it goes down. Within our homes, like I said, shalom bayit, peace, harmony in the home. We have to be flexible. We have to be willing to say, I'm not always right. She's right sometimes. Or in my case, my wife throws me a bone here and there. Sometimes I'm right. It's rare, but sometimes. But it's that willingness to say it. I share this all the time. The key in a relationship is not focusing on what I did for you. It's recognizing what they did for me. That's the key. And you have to be flexible. Yeah, I had a rough day. I probably said something the way I shouldn't have or said it at all. Okay. Suck it up, Tachman. Apologize. You were wrong. And okay, work on it next time. Be better. You got to be flexible, willingness. I've seen this in many different books. That perhaps is the reason why the mezuzah is on a slant. Why? Because there's two opinions in the Talmud as to way the position of the mezuzah should be. One opinion says it should be completely vertical. The other says it completely horizontal. There is no opinion in the Talmud that it should be on a slant. You hear that? There's two opinions, straight up or straight across. It's crossword puzzle, not bingo. There's no diagonals. But no, the mezuzah is placed on an angle because it's a compromise. And every time you walk into your home and you put your hand up to that mezuzah, remind yourself this piece of Talmud that we need to be flexible and willing to compromise. It's not always my way. It's not always her way. There's got to be a compromise somewhere in the middle. That's how a healthy shalom bias works. Whatever, there's a million. I got three more index cards worth of material here, but it's late. Any questions? Let me start there. Yes, Liz.
What are the actual prayers?
They're the first two paragraphs of the Shema.
So that's what you're supposed to say when you... That's what I mean.
You don't have to say a prayer. You just have to acknowledge. There are some who say a particular verse, but just in strict Jewish law, it says to give it a kiss. That's it. It's an acknowledgement. It's a moment that I take a thoughtful moment to say, I'm about to do X. Let me refresh my mind, what my priorities, what I need to focus on as I go in, as I go out. No actual prayer needs to be said.
Is it touch kiss or kiss touch?
Depends who else is in your house. Depends how much of a germaphobe you are.
There's not
it's the same. It's the same question when I go into shul and people are kissing the Torah as it goes around. I'm like, I don't know about that. You know? I'm okay with I touch and then I kiss. I'm good with that. I'll keep the germs here.
Got it. Thank you.
But I've seen people actually physically go up and give it a kiss. Yeah.
Don't you have to be kind of tall?
Not my house.
And I also think it's interesting in the houses that I've been in, it's not beyond moving from room to room. If there's almost like, I don't want to say a fake doorway, but if there's
a passageway.
So it depends. That's what I'm saying. I spared you the numerous chapters in the Code of Jewish Law that talk about defining a doorway. Right. I can tell you the story that when we had to redo our basement after the flood. So certain doorways I got, and I'm pretty good with that, but I'm not an expert in this field at all. I called one of the rabbis here in Baltimore and I tried to take pictures. We were still in the middle of COVID, so like he wasn't so comfortable or whatever. I sent him pictures. So he said, I can't really tell. So he said, all right, maybe I'll stop by. So it was great. He and his wife go on a walk. This is great. He and his wife, I think, walk every single morning after morning services, and they pass my block. I almost like, he waves to me often. I'm coming and he's going, or vice versa. He says to me, hey, when is camp starting? I can't wait to see the T-Mobile, because I have this huge van in front of my house for driving all the kids. So he came in and he physically went through my basement and said, oh, the way this hits up against that, there's a lot of technical law as to what qualifies as a doorway requiring a mezuzah. I will say though, that if I put up a mezuzah, let's say on a bona fide doorway, and I'm going to make the bracha on that, so there are certain, Sid called it passageways or semi-quasi doorways that may or may not require it, but I'm not going to make another bracha on it. Once I made the bracha, let's say I have to put up 15 of them. I make the bracha on just one of them, and then I put up the other 14. Once I'm putting it up, I'm not doing anything wrong by putting it up in one of those other quasi doorways that may or may not require it. According to some opinions, yes, but I wouldn't make the bracha on the questionable one. I'd make it on the definitive one, and then I can do all of them at the same time.
Thank you.
Well, yes, Sharon.
I think I know the answer, but I know you kiss it when you go in and out of the front door. Do you do it in and out of every room? Is that?
It depends how OCD you are. Technically, yes. Technically, we should acknowledge it every time we go through. Is it practical every moment? I mean, in the old days, Sharon, remember, homes were maybe one room. I'll give you two if you were wealthy. Right now we have palatial mansions of where we have, 33 doorways and 16, gates. It's like, okay. So when the halacha was written that you're supposed to, when you go in, you go out. Yeah. It meant the one or two rooms. How often did you go into your bedroom? Once a day when you went to go to sleep, that was it. The rest of the time you were in the one room that was your living room, dining room, kitchen. I mean, that's the way it was back then. So from a practical standpoint, I feel that as long as you're in the habit of acknowledging the mezuzah, you want to tell the front door always, and maybe when you go in and out of the kitchen the first time of the day, some routine is fine. It's an acknowledgement. I wouldn't make yourself crazy. There are certain kids who it just becomes their routine. They're almost subconsciously, every time they go through a doorway, their hands go up. They just go up, and they expect a mezuzah, and as they're walking, they're almost it's almost ironic. It's almost the reverse of where it's become so second nature. They're not even thinking what the mezuzah is there for. But all right, if that's the worst problem they do, I can live with that.
Rabbi.
Yes, Candy.
When the children were little, Rabbi Cosman came to our home. And he actually had lunch with us on paper plates with fruit. And afterwards, he did the blessing and he hung the mezuzahs. And Carol and Warren, Carol especially, every single time he went into his bedroom, he would always kiss the mezuzah. And several years later, we had to have the downstairs painted. and the mezuzah was taken off, and it was eventually put up. But until it went up, he still, every time he went by, he kissed he put his hand up there and he kissed it.
It's a beautiful thing.
It was just such a part of his going in and out of his bedroom.
It's a beautiful thing. It really is.
I'll say something. When you asked, if too bad I had my mute on, because I actually said, Shalom Bias, peace in the house.
There you
and
go.
I believe I knew the answer and didn't have my mute off. That was a first.
Good for you, Candy. Well done. Well done. It's a beautiful mitzvah, ladies and gentlemen. And I make the offer. If anybody wants me to come to their home, install any other mezuzahs that you may or may not have, just let me know. I would be happy to come and help you fulfill the mitzvah more. Sharon.
One, is it the same basic concept that, you know, we have it coming in and out of your classroom or your office building or wherever? So it's the same concept. Because that's kind of like your home away.
Correct. The only thing, again, there are technical things. If it's not your business or it's not your room, it belongs to others, it may not be the obligation on you. But that's a technical issue, you know.
Okay.
If I have my own office, right? I've arrived. I got my own office.
Right.
It's not a corner office, but it's an office. Right. Technically, I would have to put it up. If let's say it was a business, whatever, but it's my room and I would put one up there because it's exclusively mine. It's as if I was renting the place. It's mine. But.
And technically you are in a corner, but
that's
anyway,
true. I am in the corner. That's true.
So another thing was that sometimes like the kids, like you say, some of them automatically, some of the, that are more into that, the fact that they can't reach it. And, you know, we had thought something like, well, why isn't it put low enough for kids to reach it? But then you're missing, no pun intended, missing the mark of it being that 3/4, you know, ways down. But why shouldn't the kids be able to do that?
Who said they can't be able to do it? I got a great bit of advice for you. Get a step stool.
No, I'm just saying
that. You're asking a good question. The great Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who passed away in 1982, 3, something like that. He was a great, 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 great individual. He was asked that question. He went to there was a new school and they wanted him to come through and to, you know, so to say, offer his blessing and good luck for the future. And he noticed that in the preschool, they had put the mezuzahs much, much, much lower. And he said to them, why is that? And they said exactly what you did. And that is they wanted to teach the kids about kissing the mezuzah at a very young age so that they learn about it. He said, I commend you on doing it, but why are you teaching them in the wrong way? You're teaching them that you can put a mezuzah anywhere. That's not true. Well, they said, but how are they supposed to reach it? He said, get a chair. You don't change the rules to make it fit.
But why? All right.
You want to know why it has to be at that position.
Yeah, that side.
I brought along a book. I brought along and I said, if I get to this point, I would love to share this, but it needs another 15 minutes and I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. No,
I'll tell you this, Sharon. Picture. Okay. Try to picture the scene. You have a top piece of your lintel and you have down one doorpost. Okay. Picture in your head. That's the letter Dalet, right? Cross the top and straight down. On the other side, you have a doorpost and then you have that little third where the mezuzah sits. Picture that space is now left open, but you have the bottom two thirds. What now do you have a picture? What letter is that? If you put it all together across the top, down one side, and two thirds of the way, you have another leg, but there's a top corner piece missing. I'll give you a hint.
Cuff.
Close. Hey. Right. Hey. It's a hey.
I was going to say hey, but hey's not open.
What?
Hey is just, I didn't know hey had an opening. I thought it was just straight.
That's a chet. That's your ches. Okay. The hey is halfway. It's a little more than half. Okay. It's not for now. I want to share that. I really intended to share this whole idea. But the letter hey is what we've just described. By putting the mezuzah in that top third, right? It's leaving, so to say, space that it not be closed up the whole way. I purposely put it in that top third so that the form of that doorway now is looking like a hey. Okay, you with me? Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be a ches. I want it to be the letter hey. The letter hey, as been shared before, is the letter that represents this world. Meaning, it's open at the bottom. Right? It's completely open at the bottom. If the way the Talmud says it is that the world in which we live, if a person wants to check out and they want to, so to say, not grow and they just want to bottoms out and enjoy all the pleasures, the door is wide open to go down, right? Wink, wink, down. You know, take the elevator a few stories down. Okay? That's wide open. However, what God also did for our world is that he left a space that if you decide, if you fell down, you know what? You can come back in. How? Come around the side and through a side door. I'm making a joke of it, but that's the picture. That come on the side of the hay, you can get back in. You can't come back up the same way you came down. You come around and you have that. If it was a complete doorway, up one side, across the top, and down the other side, there's no return. There's no way back. If you fall through the bottom, you're done. That's not the Torah concept. Our world, yes, there's the opportunity and unfortunately susceptible to fall through the bottom. But it gives us the opportunity to come through the side door, up the side, the opening of the hay. The mezuzah represents that opening of godliness that allows you back in. If you go ahead and you put it somewhere else, you don't have the hay anymore. I'm oversimplifying it. Like I said, it's 15, 20 minutes, but it needs to be in that top third. And to go ahead for convenience sake, and it's coming from a good place. You want to teach the kids, but as a general rule, the best education has to be done properly. Don't teach them the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Yes, teach them there's a concept of mezuzah. But Mora, how am I going to reach it? I'm too short. Great question, Jordy. Here, come. We have a special step stool or we have a special chair. Let's kiss the mezuzah. Make that the routine. Teach it the right way. Right. That's what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky told them.
Rabbi and yes, Sharon, ma'am. One of Sharon, I don't know if you recall seeing it, but one of my favorite paintings that Rabbi Cosman did was a little boy standing on a chair with his arm reaching up to touch the mezuzah. Do you recall seeing that, Yves Shalom?
Yeah.
The winters are shaking their heads. Oh, yeah.
Yes, because
in the hallway up the steps.
Yes, and I actually have the original painting of that because, and I don't know how it happened, but I was in Kansas City with my students for a conference, and my husband Bill called and said, there are paintings being sold by Rabbi Cosman's paintings at the Frederick Fairgrounds. Do you want me to try to get you one? I said, one, you get there, and anything that has his name on it, you better buy. And that was one of the ones that he did get. And
now you understand the significance of it. This is exactly the point that Rabbi Cosman was conveying with that painting.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the point. This is a general rule. I mean, you've heard me say this many times.
Do you know the painting, Rabbi?
I vaguely remember seeing it, yes. But this is a general principle. Don't change the rules because it's more convenient. Figure out a solution to do it right. Don't change the bar because it's easier. Keep the bar. Now let's strive to figure out how to get there. But don't change it. I give the analogy. If I decide that we want to make the game of football, 5 downs and you go 5 yards for a first down, am I allowed to do that? The answer is yes. The only thing I can't do is I can't call it the NFL. The NFL has definitive rules. I can change all the rules I want, but then don't call it the NFL. It's the same here. We can make up all the rules we want, but then don't call it Torah Judaism. Torah Judaism is what it is. Can't change the rules like that. It's not Torah. You can do it, but don't call it the same name. Robin.
Yes, I want to show you where we are for a minute. In New Mexico, driving in the desert, basically, if you guys can see. It's beautiful. It's like sunset.
Wow.
You see?
Beautiful.
Yeah. We're like.
Hey, Craig, two hands on the wheel.
Oh. I can wave with one hand and drive with the other.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? No? Okay. Wonderful. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me. This was great, I hope. There really is. There's so much more to say about mezuzah. But in my mind, what I'm thinking is as follows. What I'd like to do between, just so we don't hit a time crunch and try to squeeze in everything, we're not going to get there. Maybe what our goal should be is between now and the end of May, whether it's whatever, 4 classes or so, I don't know the exact number, we should strive to get to the Amidah, to get to the Shemoneh Esrei, which means we'll talk a little bit more about the Shema, the other paragraphs, and what precedes the Shemoneh Esrei, what precedes the Amidah. And then maybe, if we're up to it, the following year after the holidays, we'll pick it up and focus exclusively on the Amidah. Maybe, if that's what's of interest, but that's my thought process. But I can throw it out there. Well, I'll know by a show of...
Look at the sun.
I'll know from a show of how many people come back that it actually was a good idea on that.
That's good.
All right. All right. Have a wonderful evening, everybody. Thank